So these are the moments that make up the stories that you probably should know about today.
But, oh, you think, do you think he was referring
excuse me,
to you?
Excuse me. I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. You should be ashamed of yourself reading that.
We're not even trying anymore. Like, they might as well put a doorstop in.
We don't need this. We don't need the American empire owning Iran. We want peace. We don't want to be murdering schoolgirls.
Yeah, we're going to have all that in an exclusive interview as well with a Pakistani journalist to find out what's really going on in the talks between the United States and Iran. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you for being one of the 10 to 20 million people who are now tuning in to watch us every single week. So, yesterday, I decided to share with you the truth about the correspondence dinner. I called the participants the so-called journalists, Chardonnay sippers, who then hide under their tables when the shooting began, because that's what's happened, right? And I mentioned that the shooting itself was really a byproduct of their own incompetence and their own corruption for failing to cover how epidemically violent America has become. One of the many stories that they hide behind those bottles of Chardonnay so they don't have to cover. So guess what happened yesterday? Last night, I get home, I'm sitting there on the couch with my wife, and all of a sudden, she starts laughing. I say, what's going on? What are you laughing about, right? She says, I'm looking at these videos and these images. Apparently, all these journalists who were invited to the correspondence dinner, there's videos all over the place now of them literally taking the wine bottles off the tables right after the shooting was done. These videos are all over the place. Here's one of them.
Tragically, we've covered shootings. We've covered all sorts of
look at this.
And terrible events.
Look at this. But it's they're sitting there. They're grabbing the bottles and putting them in their purses. They're literally taking selfies of themselves, taking the bottles. And sure enough, here it is, true to form. Images and memes and videos galore of journalists seeming to be more interested in the party and the booze and the swag and the perks than they are about doing their damn jobs after a violent shooting has just taken place right in front of them. I mean, I hate to say I told you so, but that's who these people are. What did I call them yesterday? The most corrupt journalists in the world? I used to work with them. I know their names. Yep. So, by the way, something else happened yesterday. These so-called journalists probably should have been covering. And you know what it is? How lax the security was there. They probably didn't notice it. Maybe it's because of the Chardonnay or the champagne. But you know who did notice it? Police and security officials who were there. They started, like, smelling that there was something weird, something wrong, even before the shooting took place. I'm going to play something for you that it's going to floor you. Listen to this conversation. It's caught on a hot mic, right? They don't know that they're being recorded. Two members of the security team. And they're making fun, again, before the shooting happens, at how hardly no one is being checked while they're coming into the room here. Here's how they put it.
I love that they have, like, two random chicks holding the front door open.
We're not even trying anymore.
I just mean they're not even like the service people. It's like the girls who work here are holding the door. Even if it was the guys, it wouldn't even make it better. It's like they might as well put a doorstop in. They put up a doorstop and a scarecrow. Don't with this guy.
And then there's what happened after the shooting. So the president of the United States goes on CBS News to do a post-shooting interview, I guess. Well, he obviously chose CBS because CBS is basically owned by Israel. So he was expecting, you know, softballs. You know, a softball interview really easy, friendly questions so he could hit him out of the park, right? But then something kind of weird happened. This highly paid talking head who was asking him the questions, Nora O'Donnell, who I worked with for years, by the way, at NBC, she's a very nice person. She's a very nice person. She asked the president what he thought of the shooter's manifesto. She didn't ask it in a personal way. It wasn't a personal question about the president's conduct. She was simply reading the exact words that this shooter left on this piece of paper, right? With no direct reference, by the way, to the president. She just read the manifesto in general terms. But the president, he took it personally. Boy, did he ever, right? Look at how he responds.
Mr. President, do you know if you were the target of the gunman?
I don't know. It sounded to me, I read a manifesto. He's radicalized. He was a Christian, a believer, and then he became an anti-Christian.
I'm no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction
to
that?
Well, I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because you're horrible people, horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
Do you think he was referring to you?
Excuse me. I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. You should be ashamed of yourself reading that because I'm not any of those things.
Mr. President, these are never, the gunman's words.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be reading that on 60 Minutes. You're a disgrace. But go ahead. Let's finish the interview.
You're a disgrace. That's weird, right? The fact that he became so enraged and suddenly he started insulting her for asking a question. And, you know, it makes you think of something. What was that? What was that line in Hamlet Shakespeare wrote? He doth protest too much. It does indeed sound like his denial is excessive, right? And what does that mean? That usually means when a denial is excessive, it suggests some kind of guilt. Like maybe he's feeling guilty. Maybe he's hiding something. Doth he protest too much? I'll let you decide. Here's a question for you. Why would Al-Qaeda, when was the last time we were hearing about them? Why would they lead attackers going after the government of a country in Africa? A country that, by the way, happens to have seemingly good relations with Russia. You see, for years, the Russians have been assisting the African countries, many of them in Central Africa, Western Africa, in their desire to somehow unclench themselves from the colonial rules of, you know, the Dutch, the English, the French, and many other of these European colonialists who, for centuries, more than a century, certainly occupied their lands, stole their resources. We know this. It's part of history. Killed them, enslaved them. So let me show you a map. This country we're talking about now, that's Mali. Pulling it. Look at the size of that. It's huge. It's one of the biggest countries in the world, by the way. It's in West Africa, where the French did exactly that to the people of this region for about 150 years, all but enslaved and killed them. So recently, Mali's leaders, with the help of Russians, who have joined them in trying to build new infrastructures for their country, a new government for their country. This new government essentially decided, kick the French out. They said, we don't want you anymore. So they told them, essentially, leave. However, in the past couple of days, that government that asked the French to leave came under attack. Look at these videos. Members of an Al-Qaeda-led militia attacked the government, killed Mali's Secretary of Defense, and tried to remove the Russian Africa Corps, who support the government. Why would they do that, right? Who sponsored these attackers? And who's behind this assault? Well, according to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in comments that he made in February, the French have a desire to preserve the status quo, even if it means associating with terrorists. Listen.
If we look at the situation through this prism, it becomes clear why, for example, a former colonial power such as France is trying to overthrow unwanted national-oriented governments in the countries of the Sahel region and other parts of the African continent. These countries have long since refused to take their cue from the former metropolis in all matters. But Paris is not giving up and is trying to support not only the opposition in African countries, but also openly terrorist groups.
You know what's interesting about this? The essence of the Russian relationship with both the government and the people of Mali, the Malians, right, seems to be about cooperation. Like China, Russia has promoted economic assistance as well as military cooperation and training. They've done so through the Africa Corps, which used to be part of the Wagner Group. That's now defunct. Bottom line is this. Since the attack by Al-Qaeda shell groups a few days ago, the Malians, along with the Russians, have beaten back the attackers and restored order. And they've done so with the blessing of the Turkish and Chinese governments, both of whom condemned the attacks. The matter, however, is far from over. The violence may not yet be fully settled. By the way, listen to a former ambassador of France to Mali describe why the Russians have been accepted in Mali and why the French have not, why the French have been kicked out.
The Malians finally kicked out the French army. It's understandable because there was no success, and also because it was regarded more or less as an occupying army, because it was a foreign army coming from the former colonial power. And it was not very respectful of the local sovereignty as well, because the French army fought on its own without really associating itself with the Malian army. So there were many mistakes, in my opinion, made by the French army, which are acknowledged now in France.
He's right, but will France be able to keep itself from interfering in a country it ruled for 150 years? Or will they create instability simply to thwart the fact that the Russians are now more accepted? This is still playing out. Now to Iran and the negotiations that aren't. What really happened in Pakistan? Does Iran, as it seems, have the upper hand? I think they do. Furthermore, I'm predicting, after all the interviews that I have done so far, that Iran is now on its way to becoming not just a regional power, but a new world power. Think about it. They control the Persian Gulf. Thanks to its alliance with Yemen, they also are going to control the Red Sea. That means Iran and its coalition now get to decide or control the flow of 30% of the world's oil, LNG, fertilizer, other petrochemical supplies. And there's more. Iran has now shown that it can go toe-to-toe militarily with the United States and with Israel, while forging closer, even closer ties with Russia and China. Here is President Putin, along with his advisors yesterday, meeting with Iranian Foreign Minister Arachi and his team, assuring that this alliance will continue. Add to that Iran's alliance with China, Oman, Pakistan. And what you have as you watch these pictures is an Iran that's destined to be a dominant power in the region and a power that has now weakened Israel and, to some extent, the United States. Here, don't take my word for it. Listen to how Professor Jeffrey Sachs explains this to Tucker Carlson. He explains why President Trump and the American people need to find a way for their own good to stop this war.
He has to listen to the American people. We don't want this. It's no good for us. It's anyway crazy extremism. We don't buy into this. We don't buy into the story. We don't need this. We don't need the American empire owning Iran. We don't need revenge for 1979. We don't need greater Israel. We don't need all of these things. We need our health care, our dental care, our daily lives. We want peace. We don't want to be murdering schoolgirls. We don't want to be murdering people. We don't want to be destroying ancient cultures in different places in the world. And Mr. President, your partner cannot do this for one moment without your backing. So your job is to tell Mr. Netanyahu, your clean break, 30 years, maybe $10 trillion of American treasure now piled up in debt. We tried your approach. It's done. Now we're going to try peace.
So will the president of the United States do that? Will the president of the United States, Mr. Trump, even consider that? So this is what we want to know. What's really going on in these negotiations between Pakistan and Iran? And, of course, to some extent, Israel, if not a large extent. What's their role? We decided to find out. And what we're going to do is we're going to speak with a Pakistani journalist who's an insider in these negotiations. Her name is Naseem Zara, and she's going to join us right here. When we come back, don't go away. And joining us now to talk about some of this is Naseem Zara. She is a prominent Pakistani journalist. She is an author. She is a national security specialist. And she also does something akin to what I do. She hosts a show called Naseem Zara at Pakistan on Channel 24. Naseem, it is so nice of you to take time to join us and share your perspective on all these things that are taking place right now between the United States, Israel, and Iran. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rick, for having me on the show. And good evening, good afternoon, good whatever to all your viewers. Hello to all.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, why don't we start off talking with your perspective on just where these negotiations are right now. It's getting a little confusing. We hear one thing one day from Mr. Trump, then we hear something different. Not quite sure how involved or how desirous the Iranians are of even wanting to talk to the Americans anymore. Can you add some perspective to this?
Well, I can't add perspective to what the U.S. president says because, I mean, he kind of changes his position a lot. However, I think what we are hearing from him now is that there are proposals, etc., that ideas that have come from Iran and that U.S. is looking at those ideas. So I think this is where we are. At this point, you know that the Iranian foreign minister was in Pakistan.
Yeah.
He made two visits and then he went to your country as well. He went to Moscow. Mm-hmm. And then before that, he went to Oman. So I think in about 48 hours, the Iranian foreign minister was in 72 hours. He was in Pakistan twice and he had very detailed sessions. I think I would say about four or five detailed sessions in Pakistan with, you know, with the prime minister and most importantly with the field marshal Asim Munir and with the foreign minister as well. So we basically, I think, got stuck when U.S. Went for the blockade of Hormuz, and Iran was obviously already not clearing, you know, passage for obvious reasons. But it seems like when the Pakistani field marshal Asim Munir went to Tehran, you remember he went to Tehran for 3 days in the last 1 week. And during that stay, and you know, towards the end of that stay, we know that the Iranian foreign minister tweeted that Iran is opening the Strait of Hormuz for for traffic. At that point, from what I understand, the understanding was that the U.S. president is going to kind of U.S. is going to reciprocate and that they will lift the blockade. Hmm. Instead, I think they pressed on the blockade further and said, you know, the blockade.
Mr. Trump did. That's when he seized the vessels and he had the Marines land on some ship. Yeah.
So in a sense, the latest occasion when breach of trust, it seems, took place. I mean, we're talking of the two negotiating parties, and you know, there's a lot of history there, and there's a lot of baggage there. So with these problems, subsequently, the visit of the Iranian foreign minister in Pakistan was about really, it was a bilateral visit, but also it was Pakistan and Iran and US still engaged in, you know, communicating and talking to each other on the question of what happens next. And where we are as we speak, we know that Pakistan continues to pass on messages from Iran to US and vice versa, while Iran now is saying that we will de-link the opening of Strait of Hormuz from the question of the nuclear question.
Yeah.
And so we want confidence building. When we open Strait of Hormuz and the blockade is lifted, then the second step is the second set of talks or will be about nuclear. And obviously the US is not agreeing to that. So we are in the middle of this kind of back and forth on this issue. And Pakistan obviously wanting some kind of and helping and facilitating this process, and that some kind of via medium is found and the opening takes place and the talks is.
Well, it seems like Pakistan has done a remarkable job of at least bringing the two sides together, making the April 8th ceasefire at least come to fruition. Unfortunately, it really hasn't been able to hold. Here's what I'm curious about, because I keep hearing different things. Mr. Trump keeps saying over and over again that it's the Iranians who are calling him because they want to negotiate very badly, he says, and they keep calling to negotiate. I'm not sure that's a proper characterization of things. Can you give us a better perspective? Who's calling who here? Who's really initiating these discussions? Because the Iranians are saying, we're really not that interested in talking. They give the impression that they feel like they're winning this war for what it's worth. Are they, who is calling who?
I think that Mr. Donald Trump, I think the US president, does not have many cards in his hands. I think that we can go over that subsequently. And so that the US, given how Europe has responded, given the fact what is happening within the United States, given the fact that, you know, he's had to remove his generals and the naval chief also left, given the fact that he's been called emperor, millions have come out, and the fact that they were not able to, Israel and US combined were not able to defeat Iran. You know, technologically, the most advanced army, the most equipped army is attacking a country which has been under sanctions for 40 plus years and still not, you know, defeating them. So we have a situation where you have, US has some kind of leverage when it's looking at Hormuz. It has the option to go back and bomb Iran again. We've seen, after all, what happened in Gaza. We saw that nobody stood up when this genocide was taking place. So I think that in that perspective, you can imagine that the US could take to that approach of bombing, carpet bombing, and further attacking US Iranian civilians, damaging their infrastructure and, you know, it could, hitting the economy. However, Rick, it's not about just Iran. The point is that Iran has shown to the world that on day three, it expanded the war. You know, the rationale being, as you well know, as your viewers know, that because US had bases and from there they were being attacked.
Yeah.
They not only did that, and then Strait of Hormuz blocking that from where, you know, 30% plus world energy supply, oil, crude oil goes and LNG goes. So it's a war that the entire world is engaged in, is worried about. And, you know, you said a moment ago that the ceasefire Pakistan very actively tried to work on, negotiated, and got the ceasefire. But you were saying, I heard you say that it didn't quite hold. The truth is that you had President Donald Trump basically threatening to decimate the Iranian civilization. So the world was actually at the edge of disaster. And Pakistan, for sure, was able to, you know, pull the world back. I mean, I to think
it's formidable.
The only country.
It's a formidable action. You know, you listen. Uniquely, you were able to or Pakistan was, not you, members of your government were able to come together.
Yep.
Field General Munir, for example, has been prominent in this, as have others in the Pakistani government. You know, and when you look at it, I, you know, it makes sense. Pakistan has the credibility. They have the access. They have the Muslim world's credibility as well. They have the military intelligence, weight. And they have what I think could be characterized as an acceptable neutrality that has made them the ideal brokers in this situation. You know, and there we are, in fact, looking at some of the Iranian officials with Pakistani officials. Let me play something for you here, because I was thinking about everything you said is true. And I think the world recognizes as well what you said. I think many people around the world are surprised by the way that the Iranians have been able to hold up to the United States and to the Israel. But Mr. Trump doesn't either seem to see it that way, or he doesn't want to admit this. Listen to what he said yesterday. This is Mr. Trump yesterday being asked on the tarmac about how the negotiations are going. Listen to what he says.
We canceled the trip. We have all the cards. We're not going to spend 15 hours in airplanes all the time going back and forth to be giving a document that was not good enough. And so we'll deal by telephone, and they can call us anytime they want. Again, we have all the cards. They have no military left, practically. They have no leaders left. We don't know who the leaders are. Nobody knows who the leader. I don't think they know who the leaders are, very importantly. So
he makes it sound as if the United States has actually pulverized Iran and they have nothing left. But that's not the case, is it?
Of course it's not the case. I mean, just to complete the, you know, when what you were discussing about, you know, who wants to talk, who wants an end to the war. You know, we talked about the U.S. having no cards. I mean, this is what President Trump is saying, but I told you what the facts are.
Yeah.
You know, Europe is upset. Everybody's upset. They want an end to the war. And Iran also. I think Iran is quite committed to negotiations, as we saw over the last year or so. They even Jonathan Powell, the UK NSA, then said, I was sitting in the meeting and the Iranians offered everything and we thought it was going to happen, but for what he talked about, you know, Israel, and he said Israeli representatives. At the same time, you had the Omani's foreign minister say that. And then you had the U.S. intelligence person who basically resigned saying that, you know, it was a doable thing and it didn't happen. So the Iranians still remain committed to negotiations. But I think because of what has happened, they are not as willing and as forthcoming, although let me tell you that right now the back channel is at work. It is work nonstop. And Pakistan, and particularly the field marshal, is in the middle of all this, communicating back and forth.
Okay.
And that communication is going. Mr. Trump is, the U.S. president is saying that they can call us, they can talk to us or whatever. And there's no direct phone calls between U.S. and Iran for sure. The only direct engagement interaction was when they met in Islamabad. And, you know, a 22-hour-long...
So wait, that's interesting. I didn't know that. What you just told us is that the only time that the United States has had any kind of direct communications with Iran has been actually indirect, because it's always been through the intermediary, which is the officials in Pakistan. In other words, the U.S. would call Pakistan and say, can you arrange for us a meeting with Iran? Is that the way it went?
Well, I mean, I don't think Pakistan, I think it's a kind of a much more complex thing. It's not like U.S. is going to call up and say, arrange a meeting, and then Pakistan will say, no, Pakistan has been involved in, you know, in the in substantive ways in what the issues are, and trying to get the two parties to understand each other's position, to explain to the U.S. that, you know, attacking and defeating Iran wasn't a wise thing. That is the starting point of Pakistan Field Marshal over lunch when he met last year the U.S. president and told him categorically when he was asked for advice.
But let me just interrupt you for a minute. I just want clarity on this point. I think I just heard you say that every time there have been communications, they have always been with Pakistan as an intermediary to those communications. As far as you know, there have been no direct communications between Iran and the United States without the intermediary. Is that fair?
No, except when you had the Islamabad talks, when the Americans came and the Iranians were here, they sat face to face and they talked to
each
other.
Right, when they were there. Well, let me ask you then about the one that is being described by some colleagues of ours, other journalists, as disastrous. And that was the meeting they held on, that was the 11th and the 12th, right? Yeah, this was the meeting they held on the 11th and the 12th. I think we've got some video of that, as a matter of fact. Here's J.D. Vance arriving in Pakistan. A lot of people thought this could be a real, game changer. It turned out to be a bit of a dud, in fact, and really very little, if anything, got accomplished. As the reports go, the Iranians came loaded for bear with documents and all kinds of files, and they were prepared for an offer, and the Americans were not. How would you characterize this? Why was it a dud?
I don't think that it was a zero score. I think it was a very important first step where topmost officials of the two countries met, the senior most officials who had ever met in the last 40 plus years. So it was, I think, a major ice breaking. I think it was very critical. And you know, Rick, we're talking of countries, two countries where one has been sanctioned over and over again. These are countries which are adversaries, to put it very mildly. You have United States, and it's pulling out of JCPOA, et cetera. So the meeting that took place was very important. I mean, obviously, everything is about a process. It's not like it's not a magic wand that it's just all going to disappear. This is, and I think that we can't underestimate the fact that from the bombings on a day-to-day basis, civilians dying, to a point where we have issues in Strait of Hormuz. Of course, the Israelis are attacking South Lebanon, and U.S. is not sufficiently reining them in. I think those issues are there, but overall, it's obviously we're in a process, and we've moved from zero to a few points ahead towards some kind of settlement.
Well, but if it's not zero, it's pretty close to zero, because the way the Iranians described that meeting was that they showed up, they had something they could offer, and instead all the Americans said was, "Are you guys ready to surrender?" As a matter of fact, here's Mohammed Mirandi, the professor. He was on my show yesterday. I interviewed him. Here's what he said about that meeting. I want you to react to him. Go ahead.
When the negotiations did take place in Islamabad a couple of weeks ago, the problem was that the Americans did not have the authority. I mean, Vance did not have the authority to make decisions. I mean, he was surrounded. There were three on the Iranian side, three on the American side, Kushner and Witkoff surrounded Vance, so you can imagine how the talks would go nowhere, because these two people were basically Israeli firsters. But also, Vance was constantly on the phone. He was, throughout the day, he made a dozen phone calls, including apparently to Netanyahu. So a person who's constantly making phone calls like that at the negotiating table obviously does not have authority to make decisions. Whereas the Iranian side, they didn't make any phone calls to Tehran because they knew what they could discuss and how far they could go.
I'm wondering, Nassim, what are your sources telling you about that? Is that true? Because the way he describes it, it almost sounds like Mr. Vance didn't have the authority to make any calls during that meeting.
So Rick, I didn't hear him say that there was zero progress. I didn't hear him say that, there was no discussion. I didn't hear him say that there was nothing substantive. What he's saying, and that is correct, that there was no decision-making that the vice president of the decision-making power he seemed to exercise. Mm. And that, from what I've heard from multiple sources is, including people on the Iranian side, that it seemed like it would get somewhere that negotiations had the Americans stayed on for an extra day. So that something was moving ahead.
Yeah.
There was discussions. And remember that there was a genuine ceasefire. But number one, Vance pulling out. Number two, basically not pulling out, but returning to say, you know, not accepting what we're saying. So I think that it was, I would again say that it was an important first step. And the process continues. There is at no point since then to now that there hasn't been communication where Pakistan is not communicating with Iran. And as you know, you've had meetings back and forth. You've had visits, actually. And at the same time, communication with the United States. So Iran, United States are still exchanging notes, are still looking at what is possible, what is not possible. But Iran, after what the United States did in terms of first the blockade and then subsequently, from what I hear, there was some agreement that the Iranians will end the, you know, open Strait of Hormuz and the Americans will lift the blockade. That didn't happen. So you are now at a point where some kind of trust needs to be built so that the two sides accept what is going to be mutually beneficial. I mean, these are negotiations. Yeah. It can't be zero for either side.
No. And that's positive. Listen, and it's encouraging to hear you say that. I know you're someone who is very trusted and very recognized in your country. So I'm sure you have sources that are very credible. And the sense that you're giving us is that right now, as we speak, the negotiations are continuing and both sides are talking through back channels. That's what I hear you saying. Here's another thing I probably should ask you about, because we heard reports about this and it was confirmed to me again yesterday by Mohammed Mirandi. And that is that the Iranian side is concerned that if they get on a plane and fly to Islamabad, they're concerned for their safety. Do your sources in the government guarantee the safety of those Iranian officials, that the Air Force of Pakistan will protect them to make sure that they're not blown out of the sky? They're concerned because other negotiators in the past have been assassinated by the United States. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, Rick, I'm just saying nobody in Pakistan is going to confide in me to say this is what is about to happen and this is how we'll protect. Let's see, the taste of the pudding is in the eating. What have we seen during the last two visits? The kind of security the Iranian delegations got. But most importantly, you're talking about the guest on your show, but I would refer you to the X accounts of the Iranian foreign minister and the Iranian ambassador in Pakistan. They went at length to thank Pakistan for the security that was provided, for the, you know, the sense of comfort, etc. So I think that people can have opinions, but we must look at what the facts are.
Well, no. I don't think Iran has any problem with Pakistan. Their problem is they read a report in the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, pardon me, that suggested that the United States should shoot down their plane when they leave Islamabad, and that put the thought in their head that somebody in the United States might be crazy enough to do it. It would be the responsibility of Pakistan to protect them if they're the brokering country, right?
Yeah, so I think that Pakistan is mindful of it. Everybody's mindful of, you know, what potential threats can be. We obviously haven't seen this kind of, killing and slaughtering of top leadership as we have seen happen in this war by Israel particularly.
Yeah, by Israel, and, correct.
So I think this is something that will be inevitably discussed, but I don't have a sense at all that either on the Iranian side or on the Pakistani side, they entertain any doubt that something like this can either take place or can be taken lightly. So I think on the security front, they Iranians are quite
comfortable. Do you get a sense? Here's another interesting question that I should ask you. Do you get a sense, as Mr. Morandi, or Professor Morandi mentioned a little while ago, that, because you just mentioned the Israelis, and obviously Mr. Netanyahu is very present, it seems. You get a sense that Mr. Netanyahu is somehow shaping these negotiations, that he is a voice in these negotiations, even though he's not there? And let me put the picture up of the people, some people call his agents, and that's Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Jared Kushner, who, as you know, are very close to Mr. Netanyahu. And every time there's a negotiation with Iran, these two characters show up. What are your thoughts, and what do your sources tell you about Mr. These two guys and their involvement, or Mr. Netanyahu's involvement?
Yeah, I mean, it's not sources. It's in an area I work on, I study, and, you know, it's just like what everybody knows if you keenly study this area.
Yeah.
Obviously, they are very trusted by the U.S. president, and they are trusted and are extremely close to Israel. And hence, when the question of just these two even surfaced during the first talks, when the first talks were being organized, it was made very clear, I think, by the Iranians that it has to be somebody else, just not these two people. But they are part of Mr. Donald Trump's, I think, core team. And Iran is very mindful of it, is very conscious of it. And I think, and that's the important thing. And they will obviously want a very, very thorough, discussion on anything and everything, and which is why the vice president's, Mr. Vance's presence was important.
Yeah.
And Israel's influence, I mean, what can one say? It's very clear that Israel has is the one, if you go by the by American press, and I think it was Washington Post, where there was this whole story about, I think it was Washington Post or New York Times, where in February, Mr. Netanyahu came to the U.S. president and made a whole presentation, reportedly, and said, you know, if you attack, A, B, C, D will happen, and you'll decimate Iran. So, and also the whole greater Israel idea of Israel and what it's been doing and how it has gone into West Asian lands, Muslim lands, what it's done in the last, 2025 onwards. Before that, obviously, the genocide, as it continues, we are seeing it. But we were, I think that the U.S. has to now be very clear that either it just stands with Israel, or it throws the entire global economy into a spin that even the United States cannot afford.
Well, you know, Professor, here's something interesting for you. Professor Jeffrey Sachs, I just played it a moment ago, literally is telling the United States, you need to separate yourself from Israel. This is crazy. He basically makes the point that for 30 years, we've done everything Israel wants us to do, and it has gotten us nowhere. It has not improved the region. It has not improved the condition for Americans. It has costed us American blood, American treasure, et cetera, et cetera. It's time to say, we know you guys want us to constantly be at war on your behalf in these Muslim countries. We're going to give peace a chance. Sorry. We're trying something new. That's what Sachs says the United States should do. Do you agree?
Without a doubt. I mean, haven't we seen what Israel was wanting and was targeting? It was targeting infighting between GCC countries. It was targeting infighting between Iran and Saudi Arabia. When we talk about Pakistan's role, I think we need to also acknowledge that Pakistan worked over time diplomatically, politically, to ensure that Iran and Saudi Arabia didn't come to blows. How many times was false flag operation conducted by Israel? The attack on Iran's Kurg Island, the oil main oil drilling island.
Yeah.
You know that they attacked, and then Iran retaliated, and there was going to be a near war situation between Saudi Arabia and Iran. It seems like it, and that was prevented. So Israel is not my friend, it's a story that goes back 100 years plus. But for sure, what we've seen in the last few years, it has destabilized. The genocide that we also, it's an irony that the genocide of the Palestinians did not move the Europeans, did not move the Canadians, did not move anybody. Yeah. It is now the fact that the global economy is being hit. You have all these countries rise up and say, the U.S. has to be wiser. So Israel's policy of greater greater Israel is one that has been, that has created havoc in not just the region, not just West Asia, but far beyond. And it continues with that policy. It's the only country which has no borders. It is a country which has no declared borders. It is not a signatory to IAEA. It has bombs. It has used an imagined threat to bulldoze, whether it is South Lebanon, whether it's other countries, whether it's Syria around it. So what I'm saying is that obviously there was going to be response. Iran came up with its responses, over the years. So now is the time for U.S. To do the wise thing. And I think that President Donald Trump has it in him. Yesterday at a discussion, some friends were saying that you have, it's the China problem that has created this war. And I beg to differ on that. I think that Donald Trump's engagement with China, Rick, seems to be much more pragmatic, much wiser than what is happening.
Well, yeah, I think that's the next thing. And maybe that's where we conclude, because I think this has been a wonderful conversation. But I'm trying to get a sense of how you see this. It looks like the entire world, at least I was, I don't know. Let me ask you this. Were you as surprised as I was to see how Iran has responded? Did you think they would be as effective as they have been in taking out the American and Israeli anti-missile defense system? Did you think that their economy would grow instead of stagnate during this time? Did you think they'd be able to hold and control the Strait of Hormuz as they have? And do you think, as some economists have told me right here on this show and others, that this is not just now, the future bears and bowls well for Iran? Iran will now be a regional power, if not a slight world power, because of what just has happened here. Do you see it that way? Do you think that's going to be the result of all of this in the end?
Well, I think that Iran has already shown to us that staying under sanctions still facing 40 days of bombing, of attacks, of sabotage, of their people being killed, their leadership, their Rehber Ayatollah Khamenei was martyred. All the things that they did, and they thought that the Iranian setup was going to collapse. It didn't happen. And so the Iranians have already told the world that, our security we can take care of, as they did. They turned it all into a missile war. As far as the Strait of Hormuz is concerned, U.S. with all its naval flotillas can do nothing about opening the Strait of Hormuz unless the Iranians agree. But it's 22 kilometers, it's narrow, etc. So just to give you some examples, and beyond that, they have managed their agriculture, their food security situation, such that you don't get stories of the Iranians starving after this 40-day attack from the U.S. and Israel. So it seems that Iranians are capable of facing hardships. They are. It's a government that continues to work, to function. It's an army that doesn't collapse under pressure. So these are people who will obviously fight back. And once sanctions are removed, once we go past this stage, I see Iran emerge as an important country in the region for sure.
Yeah, yeah. We have an expression in America. We say it's the story we all learn when we're little kids. I'm sure you've learned it. the little train that could, right? It's the little train that could, that everybody thought this train can't go anywhere. And all of a sudden it's like chug, 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 chug. And suddenly the train starts moving and it turns out to be a train that can do a lot of things. Well, that's kind of like the story of Iran right now. I've told my Iranian friends, I said, I thought you guys were going to get walloped. I thought you guys were going to get destroyed. And it was going to happen in like the first week because of the U.S. military and the predominance of the Israelis in the region alone. It's actually been quite the opposite. I think just like I just said, that I see Iran in a more powerful position and in a more viable position in the future, I think this does not bode well for Israel. I see issues for Israel in the future coming out of this. Do you agree?
I think that I would say that many of us saw it differently. We've seen Iran. We've seen how Iran has managed to survive these 40 plus years of sanction and, you know, all kinds of targeting. So yeah. I think that there are fewer people in our country, certainly, who were surprised. And we didn't think that it was going to be a walkover. We saw it in 2025, and certainly it wasn't a walkover. And in addition to that, you have a situation where, their military strategy, it's not just that they had the resolve, they had the, they had a strategic outlook, yes, the way they dealt with the military thing. And Pakistan has been very clear. I mean, I think Pakistan, since 2025, Pakistan has a very old relationship, neighborly, brotherhood kind of relationship with Iran. And Pakistan knew what Iran was about, which is what the field marshal also conveyed to the U.S. president. And I think that Pakistan feels it's certainly on the right side of history and emerging as a country with its own diplomatic history, standing right out up there and telling the world it has to be some principles, it has to be rules. Pakistan is playing the role that the United Nations should have been playing.
Yeah.
It's the only country in the world that had the convening power to pull these together and at least save us from a catastrophe. I hope that it ends up in some settlement.
Point well made. Nassim Zara. Boy, what a pleasure it's been to have this conversation with you, to get a perspective from you as an insider, really, understanding what's been happening with these negotiations. And it's good to hear you say that the negotiations are continuing. Both sides are talking through the intermediaries in Pakistan. And we'll all hope and pray that it comes to some type of fruition at some point. Thank you so
pleasure
much.
Pleasure to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you on my show. Thank you, Nassim, for being with us. Thanks. We really appreciate it. Well, and that's it for us. I do want to tell you, though, how grateful we are for you, for being here, for sharing of yourselves, of your families. We keep getting tens of thousands of comments and emails and checks from you. I don't mean money checks, but you checking on us and us checking on you, telling us what you think, telling us what you believe about the stories that we cover and the interviews we do. And some of them are really positive. Some of them are not. That's okay. We appreciate both types of comments. We'll be looking for you again here. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll see you next time.